All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Sandhill Road. And I'm super excited to have my guest with me here today, Ali Tamaseb, who is a founder turned venture capitalist at Data Collective. And we're here to talk about his recent book. It's been a long time in the making, and I've started following the process in December of 2018 when he published the first Medium post on the subject matter, and it has now turned into a wonderful book, Super Founders. Ali, you ready to take it from the top?
Of course. Let's do it.
So where does this podcast find you today?
I'm at home in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Wonderful home. And we can see the book already in the background. To kick things off, let's talk a little bit about you. You're not an academic. You're not a writer. You're actually a founder turned venture capitalist at Data Collective. As part of this work, you've sort of stumbled into this rabbit hole of collecting all of this data and engaged on this book project. But maybe before we jump into the book, maybe talk a little bit about yourself.
For sure. So, yeah, I mean, I was a founder before. I've started companies before, various level of, you know, success and failure. The last company I was working on, it was an industrial hardware company producing wearable technologies. I came to Silicon Valley about 5 years ago. And, you know, the way I got into venture was actually through writing as well, writing in Twitter. And I was publishing some of my thoughts about, you know, what would be good thesis areas for investing in healthcare and AI and in blockchain infrastructure. And I was writing about those back in 15 and 16 and 17. That's how I found myself, you know, networking with a lot of, you know, investors and venture capitalists. And all of a sudden, you know, there was an opening. There was a firm that we wanted to work together. So I joined Data Collective, DCVC. For those who may not know, DCVC is a Silicon Valley-based venture capital firm. It started about 10 years ago from a very small fund, but now it's one of the larger funds, I would say, in Silicon Valley. We manage over $2 billion. Our latest fund is a $725 million fund, all focused on deep tech. So we typically don't invest in consumer apps or SaaS software. What we love to invest is companies that are solving something very complex in terms of engineering or science. So that includes a lot of, you know, therapeutics, manufacturing, construction. I love old industries. I've invested in mining technologies, in material and food, and obviously healthcare, blockchain infrastructure, the other kind of more mainstream type of industries. And we typically lead seed and series A checks. So I've been fortunate in my time of, you know, being an investor to have, you know, made about 15 investments. I've led, you know, number of companies. Some of them have become very successful. Carbon Health, that's, you know, they now employ about 2,000 people. It's a unicorn. Starkware, that's another good one. That's a blockchain infrastructure company that's taken a lot of strides and a number of others.
And so let's start off talking a little bit about the motivation for this book. You were collecting this data and you continue to hear all these stereotypes. And there's this saying around Silicon Valley being really a pattern matching ecosystem. VCs look for certain traits in founders, for certain traits in companies, for certain founder team combinations. And you set out to sort of debunk a lot of these stereotypes, or you wanted to know, is there really some truth to it? Maybe talk a little bit about this initial spark of motivation.
So I think the initial part of that came from an internal motivation to become a better venture investor. You know, a lot of investors, when they want to become better investors, they ask other people, what are your patterns? What do you look for? And just from my experience, you know, being a founder and then later investor, seeing some of these companies that succeeded versus the ones that did not, I felt like a lot of these patterns do not match with reality, or a lot of these stereotypes are not matching the reality. So I said, you know, there should be something in the data. If somebody were to collect data on every company that succeeded and every company that failed, something should come out of that. And I searched very hard and very long for that, and there's nothing out there. Nobody has done this work before. Because it's a very tedious manual task. And obviously there's been different researchers that have done different parts of this, mostly around funding or mostly around, you know, a little bit of background in the founders, but not, for example, about competition, not about, you know, market dynamics, not about the career path of the founders or the way these people fundraise or where the ideas came from. So there's a lot of different elements. So I wrote 65 different elements that I thought, you know, may somehow matter in what a startup would end up becoming. And I collected these 65 data points on all the billion-dollar companies that were created in the past 14 years. And also I randomly sampled a group of companies that, you know, raised a minimum of $3 million in venture capital funding, but did not become unicorns that I can compare and contrast on each of these data elements. And while I was collecting this data, I realized, you know, the data is telling me a bunch of these things don't matter. Like when I finished the analysis, it turns out a lot of factors that people stereotypically think are related or are correlated with success does not matter. And then a bunch of new kind of signals or new information unearthed itself. So it's a very, I would say it's a very valuable data set that shows us a bunch of new patterns and also dispels, more importantly, dispels a lot of myth and stereotypes in Silicon Valley and tech and investor entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about this and what a lot of people don't realize is they would maybe tell you, well, why don't you just go on Crunchbase? But the kind of dimensions that you collect, this is not readily available data. And so you had to go through a lot of internet archives, podcasts, news outlets. You had to be very creative. And this primary data collection exercise, it really started in 2017. And it took you, I think, a couple of hundred hours to just collect the basic dimensions for your data set. Maybe talk a little bit about, you know, why are you such a venture nerd? You know, why did you do this? Where did you take the motivation for doing this on the side?
Yeah, I mean, this you're right. This data doesn't exist anywhere. You know, Crunchbase, PitchBook, a bunch of these sources, they have data on what the name of these companies are and maybe who are the investors. And also, even that data is not accurate. On the dimensions that I wanted to see these companies, I had to, you know, go through LinkedIn profiles, through internet archives, listen to previous interviews, listen to podcasts. In some cases, I even cold emailed some of these founders, you know, asked them, hey, is this true or is this not? Can you confirm this not? I'm doing a study. And a lot of these people, you know, responded back. And that's how, you know, I collected this 30,000 data points like one by one by one. And that's why it took 4 years. I think the motivation came from, you know, I thought this is something that obviously should have been done. And it was weird to me that nobody had done it before. But I guess the reason it's hard, it takes a long time and you can't automate it. You can't outsource it. Somebody with the judgment or the intuition that they have should have done this research manually. So I'm glad I put the time and, you know, it revealed a lot of insights to me and it, you know, I hope it helps me become a better investor and also, you know, help push the industry forward a little bit, maybe take some biases out and help investors be better, help more people start companies, help more failed founders come in and go at it again. You know, there's a lot of inspiration you can find in the data and also in the interviews that I hope would help the venture industry forward and help more founders take a pass to become a founder of a successful company.
Absolutely. I think it's super fascinating what you put together there. And if I can double click a little bit on the data set, it's a data set that's collected for the time frame between 2005 and 2018. And it includes data from the well-known unicorns, the Ubers, the Airbnbs of this world, but also some lesser known companies, a company like Nevro, a maker of a medical device. Let's talk a little bit about finding those lesser known companies and finding information on those that are not always seen on the headlines of TechCrunch.
Yeah, the good thing about data collection is, or like doing any type of study like this, is you have to be comprehensive. You can't create a bias and say, but this is not, or this is a unicorn and this is not. There's certain metrics. If you're valued over $1 billion and if you are, you know, within certain categories, this is a startup, this is a unicorn. And it's fascinating that, you know, there's a little news on the majority of these, you know, 200 plus companies, and there's a lot of news on the top 20. And basically that creates a narrative bias. You know, we are more likely to think and create the patterns with only those, you know, 10 or 15 that get the attention. It's the Stripes and the Ubers or the Amazons of the world. But, you know, there's 200 something companies that have succeeded, and there's thousands of companies that have failed that we can draw patterns and understand from them. And obviously the data collection, the lesser known the company was, the data collection was harder, obviously. It was much harder for the failed companies or the companies that, you know, didn't become a massive success. But again, most of these data you can find, you know, you can find and read in between the lines and the LinkedIn profiles of these founders or executives and the Crunchbase profiles, or like old interviews of these companies that, you know, maybe didn't go anywhere. And you have to go very far back into, you know, the first year that the company was created to get to the source of truth about these companies.
I would say let's now dig really into the findings. Let's start with the age. And there's obviously this huge myth in Silicon Valley of, you know, creating a company out of the college dorm room. We have the Zuckerberg, the Bill Gates dropout from Harvard. And there's really this ageism in Silicon Valley. And so one really interesting finding you have is that the median age of founders in Silicon Valley is actually 34. Talk a little bit about ageism in Silicon Valley and this first major finding that you don't have to be 20 to start a company.
Yeah, so I guess this bias kind of goes in different cycles. In the 90s, and like East Coast way of thinking and venture investment, they always wanted the gray hairs. They always wanted, you know, to bring, like, invest in the old people, like people who have had a longer time with more experience. Nowadays, I would say it's the reverse. There's ageism against people who are older and more experienced, and there's a bias for, you know, if you're a dropout, if you've done this by the age of 19, you should be successful, right? Or at least that exists in the media. Like every news that you read talks about how this 23-year-old, you know, founder did this. Nobody talks about, you know, the company, or nobody talks about how this 47-year-old founder did this. Because that's not exciting news. And that, again, creates a narrative bias. So the data showed, you know, comparing these billion-dollar companies with companies that got venture funding but, you know, didn't get anywhere, there's no correlation between age and success. It's a lot more it's deep-rooted into the characteristics of these founders. And you might be 47 and, you know, don't have those characteristics. You might be 18 and have those characteristics. So that's basically how, you know, the age by itself is not a correlation factor. The median age was 34 years old. And it's not just Silicon Valley. It's every billion-dollar company created in the U.S. and every, you know, $3 million venture-funded company created in the U.S. That's also 34. And then in healthcare and biotech, it skews older. That's like 42 is the median, which doesn't mean you have to be 42 or older or younger. It's just saying, you know, that's the median, and there's no right or wrong in terms of how old you are. You might be 18. You might have done a bunch of companies before. You might be 52 and you may have never had any entrepreneurial in your background or had nothing before. So that's the finding from the book. And I interview Enrique from Brex, that kind of first chapter, talking about, you know, how being young helped him.
Yeah, I think he's a great example of a recent super young founder. But let's move on to a related and really interesting second finding, which is about the number of optimal number of co-founders. At Y Combinator, they almost tell you that you shouldn't apply as a solo founder. And there's this saying around the optimal number of co-founders is two, having one technical guy and one commercial guy. And it's another myth that you debunk in your data set. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, this goes back again to the narrative bias that we have. We've seen so many examples of these successful dual co-founders. From going back all the way from HP to Google founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, to, you know, Steve Jobs and Wozniak, the story about, you know, Wozniak and Jobs, that's how you have, you know, a technical genius and you have a business savvy visionary, or product savvy visionary. And that seems to create this stereotype or narrative that's the perfect founding team. Again, when I compare the two groups, it turns out the number of co-founders is not correlated with success. You're not less or more likely to succeed because of the number of co-founders you have. There's probably things about, you know, the dynamics of how these co-founder relationships are or what each person brings to the table that matters. But on its own, you know, these are not correlated. Solo founder, you know, 1/5, 20% of unicorns was with solo founded. And then, yes, two co-founders is the most common, but it doesn't mean that you're more likely if you have two co-founders. There's a lot of successful companies with three co-founders and four co-founders. What I saw in the data was it seems like one of these co-founders is always dominant, not always, but in many of these cases, is the dominant founder, typically the CEO. They own more shares, they set the vision. And, you know, a lot of these companies obviously have a single CEO. So that may matter. Another thing that I found was in 45% of these unicorns, these founders either went to the same school or worked at the same company before. So sometimes there's this history between them, a history of trust. And another very counterintuitive thing that I saw in the data was if you are a non-technical founding CEO of a billion-dollar company, it's more possible that your second person in the company, your co-founder, is also non-technical, which is very weird. You would assume if you're non-technical, your co-founder is technical and the other way around. But if you're a technical CEO, it's more likely your second person is also technical. If you're a non-technical CEO, it's more likely your second person is non-technical too. The point is none of these necessarily make or break a company. The aim of the book is to break some of these stereotypes and proxy rules, not to say you should be two non-technical people or you should be two technical people. Like basically it's saying none of these rules necessarily matter. Like do what's best for your company, disregarding what's norm or what's typical.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree. And then let's move on to the next topic, which is education. And there's another common false narrative, I would say, that you debunk in your book, which is, you know, this myth around the college dropout. Maybe talk a little bit about that. I don't want to take away too much from the thunder there of your findings.
Sure. I think, again, because it makes for an interesting story, we think that a lot of these successful founders were college dropouts. It turns out it's mostly an exception. Only 4% of billion-dollar company founders were, you know, these Ivy League college dropouts. The other 9, you know, looked more like the other people. They had bachelor's degrees. 21% had MBAs. Some had medical degrees. Some had law degrees. Some were professors. Some were high school dropouts. And again, when I compare the two groups, it shows that education level by itself is not correlated. So if you've raised, you know, a little bit of money, then what was your level of education doesn't matter. And yet there are more PhDs than dropouts. And I think a lot of people have a bias against PhDs, you know. PhDs can't start companies. There's more PhDs.
I know all about this. So, I know all about biases against PhDs, man.
Right, yeah. So, you know, you've probably heard about all these different biases. There's sometimes biases for or against MBAs. And again, the data shows these are non-correlated.
To drill one level deeper again, let's talk a little bit about the kind of institutions that the founders go to. To a large degree, these are signal institutions that they go to. Maybe talk a little bit about that aspect.
Yeah, so when I looked at the rankings of the universities that the founders of, you know, billion-dollar companies had gone to and compared it with the random group, it is true that a larger proportion of founders of these unicorns did go to Stanford, did go to Harvard, did go to MIT, and these kind of top schools. However, there's two other things that the data found. Number one is there were as many founders of billion-dollar companies who had gone to schools that were top 100 as those who had gone to the schools that were in the top 10. So if you look at the distribution, yes, the ones that went to top 10 are more likely, and you can find more of them in the unicorns group. But still, there's as many founders who went to, you know, schools not even in the top 100 as those that went to top 10 schools. That's one. The other thing is it's not directly correlated with their ranking. Location and the entrepreneurship culture has a high effect too. So for example, you don't see Caltech or Princeton or University of Chicago in the list of, you know, large producers of unicorns, but you do see University of Southern California, you do see the University of Michigan, you do see San Jose State, you do see, you know, so it seems like location, the entrepreneurship culture also have a big impact. You know, if the alumni of a university have created a bunch of companies and maybe some of them are successful, that brings back some of that entrepreneurship culture and some of those connections to these universities.
I think that's super interesting. I think another interesting aspect that you highlight is that this pattern of top-tier universities or top-tier institutions perpetuates once the founders enter the workforce, and you make an interesting classification of top-tier employers or top-tier companies, the likes of McKinsey, I think, or Goldman Sachs or Microsoft or Amazon, you list there. And you find that a number of founders actually have a background, a pre-founding employment at one of these top-tier companies.
Yes. So I think one stereotype that may exist is thinking that the founders of these billion-dollar companies, they had worked for a year or two somewhere and started these companies. Number one, it turns out on average, they had worked for 11 years on other stuff before building their billion-dollar company. That's number one. And when you look at those 11 years, that's either they had mostly worked for themselves, so they had created companies before, maybe they failed, maybe they were small successes. Of those that had not worked for themselves, the rest, they were more likely to have worked for these kind of tier one companies. As you said, like 60% of those had worked in companies like Google, McKinsey, and you know, Amazon. But it's also very interesting that the other, you know, 30% had worked for themselves all that time, kind of creating companies, grinding through, maybe failing a bunch of times, and then starting that kind of billion-dollar company.
Yeah, and now let's get to the really juicy bit, which is the origin of the term super founder. And it emerges out of this one section of your book where you talk about the serial entrepreneurs. And you mentioned there in the section that many successful founders not only had prior experience as employees before, but also as founders. As a venture capitalist, you pay a premium on serial founders. You create the term super founders. It is someone who has founded at least one company that either exited for at least $10 million or had over $10 million in revenues. So you're not excluding the bootstrap company founders here, which I found really great. Maybe talk a little bit about this class of super founders.
Sure. So the data kind of goes into the previous entrepreneurial endeavors of these successful founders. Number one, it's great to see 40% of these billion-dollar founders are first-time entrepreneurs. So I don't, you know, number one, I don't think there should be any bias against the kind of first-time entrepreneurs. However, when I compared the billion-dollar group and the random group, you clearly see that those that were on the second or third or fourth try, they were more likely to succeed, even if they had failed before, even if their previous companies were like very small outcomes. And the main thing that I saw in the data, it's not about, you know, I think when people talk about serial entrepreneur, they expect, you know, if you have sold your previous company for $250 million, now, you know, I'm going to pay a premium price for you. The goal of this chapter of the book is actually, you know, that $10 million bar is an arbitrary number. I talk about, you know, why this is an arbitrary number. The aim is, you know, if you've started a company and it was a small success, maybe it was an acqua hire, maybe, you know, somebody bought your source code, maybe you wrote and sold something online and created some real value out of that first startup, then in your next company, you've already accumulated so much resources and network and, you know what type of people to hire, that then you become more likely. So there's a bunch of kind of good examples. One is Alex Tew, founder of Calm. It's a $2 billion meditation app. And when you go look at his past, when he was, you know, a 22-year-old student at Nottingham University, he created this website called the Million Dollar Homepage. It's quite fascinating. It's like a 1,000 by 1,000 pixel of you know, grids. And advertisers would pay, you know, $1 per pixel by this, like before display ads was something. He made $1 million like that. This is the thing that, you know, the founders who had this bug for creating something, for like making some money online and had this hustle, they're much more likely to start billion-dollar companies than somebody who was, you know, steadily moved above the rank in Google. That's the point I'm trying to make. The founders of Stripe, super young, and that's why we talked about, you know, the age by itself doesn't matter. But before Stripe, they had started this auction management company that was acquired for $4.5 million. If you look back into, you know, the founder of Spotify, he had sold this kind of little project for $1 million, like an advertising company. So in different, and this also holds for a lot of international companies. Like if you look at the founder of Careem, the Uber of Middle East, if you go and look at a bunch of founders in, you know, in Asia that become successful, you see this pattern that, you know, they always had this bug for creating a bunch of side hustles and, you know, creating companies, and some of them failed, some of them were like small outcomes. And that's kind of what this chapter is talking about, that, you know, if your first startup was a small outcome, go at it again, do it again, use the learnings, and, you know, this time you're more likely to build a billion-dollar company.
Listen, I love this aspect. And this is really the aspect of the book where I just had to pick up the phone and call a friend of mine and told him, like, this section is it's pure gold, where you said, like, the most important thing is that you always have to, if you want to be a founder, you always have to be creating something. You have to be that type of person, whether it's like a hobby project, a side hustle, a school club, just the pure fact that
nonprofit,
you're creating something, gets you out of this passive mode that many people are in today. Let's move on to another great section where I think it really showed that you did not collect just, you know, the headline items, but that you went one level deeper, and it's about the product. And you collected this data, or you classified the data on whether the products created by the billion-dollar startups were painkillers or vitamins. Maybe talk a little bit about this.
So the definition is basically, you know, if you're a painkiller, there is existing pain, the customer knows about it, and you take that away. It's about taking away a pain. When you're a vitamin pill, you're making something better. You're making something more entertaining. You're kind of adding something. And so that's kind of, I try to make the definition a little bit more tangible. So when I collect the data, it makes sense. So it turns out, you know, this is not a stereotype. This is correct. Painkillers are more likely to win and succeed than vitamin pills. However, when again you look at the data, turns out, you know, 1/3 of all the billion-dollar companies, they were vitamin pills. So if you're creating a vitamin pill that creates a habit, that creates, you know, sticky product, that creates a community, that creates a brand, then it's possible that companies can succeed, and it's possible that this company can become a, you know, multi-billion-dollar outcome. But again, it's better, and you're more likely to succeed if it's a, you know, well-defined pain and you're a painkiller. However, these vitamin pills work too.
I really love this, because a lot of startup ideas, I think, are dismissed prematurely by just trying to be too novel and too disruptive. Because a lot of people think, okay, I have to have this great idea for something absolutely novel and disrupting. And I think it feeds really well into the next point about competition and about the competitive landscape that some of these startups are facing. Maybe talk a little bit about what you found there.
Yeah, one main thing that a lot of startups try to say is that we don't have competition. And I think a lot of people try to take that as a point of pride, that, you know, this is a completely new space. Nobody else is doing this. Nobody else knows anything about this. And it turns out 85% of billion-dollar companies did have competition from day one. Only 15% did not have any competition. Although it's important to see what type of competition it was. So the most common case among these billion-dollar companies was when you were competing with an incumbent company, an old, giant, sleepy company that cannot catch your speed and would not, you know, does not have the talent to come after you. So that's one category. And if you do that, you're more likely to succeed. The second most common category is when you go into a market that is fragmented. There's a lot of players, but everyone is a small player. Everybody has single digit market share. And the example I talk about there is Flexport in the freight shipping industry. And you may think that, you know, FedEx and companies like that have a lion's share, but they don't. Like in specifically in that kind of, you know, shipping massive things from Taiwan to the US, they're not the biggest player, or they're not the only player. There's 20, 30 companies, each of them with 2, 3% market share, that have existed since, you know, at least 40 years ago, each of them. And a company like Flexport can go in and create a new position for themselves and bring talent and, you know, startup mentality and speed to a very fragmented market. The least common case that I saw in the data was when you were competing with another startup, when you were competing with another highly funded startup. So if you're copying, if you're a copycat, and it turns out a lot of VCs and investors funded those types of companies, but if you're copying what another startup is doing and you're just behind them, then these companies are less likely to succeed.
I think Reid Hoffman calls this the black hole of hyper-competition. If you go into a very obvious and capital-intensive space and sort of everybody's is overcapitalized, and it gets really hard to break out as a company. And this brings me to the next point on the typical VC memo, which is around defensibility. And you talk about this and collected some data on this, that and where sort of the billion-dollar startups got their defensibility from. And interestingly enough, network effects is not the leader when it comes to defensibility, but it's actually engineering. But maybe talk a little bit about defensibility and the different categories you identified there.
Sure. Yeah, so I think defensibility can come from a number of things. One of it is engineering, just how hard this thing is for anyone else to replicate. And none of these sort of defensibility factors are like super long-term. Like you can break a network effect. You can break engineering defensibility. You can even break IP defensibility. These are all about creating these barriers that, you know, you will always stay ahead, you know, 6 months from the competition. And you can always create the next product and the next generation of the product. The most common case that I found was these companies were defensible through engineering. However, the network effects does matter. So it's not the most common, but when you compare it with the non-unicorn group, then you see its value. The companies that had network effects were a lot more likely to become these successful billion-dollar companies. So it definitely certainly matters. And obviously you have the other source. It seems like generally what matters is defensibility does correlate with success. Like companies that have something that is defensible, even if it's just a brand, then they are more likely to become billion-dollar companies compared to companies that like don't have anything that makes them defensible or unique or like highly differentiated in the marketplace. It could be engineering, it could be IP, it could be network effects, it could be brand, it could be scale, but it's something rather than nothing.
Maybe let's move on to the next aspect, which I personally quite loved. It's this old question of VC funding versus bootstrapping. And actually, in the last episode, I had Justin Jackson from Transistor FM on, who bootstrapped more than $1 million ARR in less than 3 years. And he really swears by bootstrapping. But obviously, from the VC side, there's always this old saying that this is going to be a lifestyle business and that there's no way to create a $1 billion company by bootstrapping. And then there are these recent examples like Qualtrics, which bootstrapped for years. And what I liked about your data set is that you made room for the bootstrapped companies in the first place by making this definition of having companies that didn't raise venture funding in the first 4 years, you classified them as bootstrapped companies. And I think it's a very fair definition. Maybe talk a little bit about what you found with respect to bootstrapping.
Yeah, so I think in that chapter, I talk a lot about the history of venture capital and, you know, how recent this thing is and how small venture capital as an asset class is compared to the financial system. It's ridiculously small, but it has an outsized impact. And that's why we get to talk about, you know, a lot of these venture-backed companies. So the data shows, you know, over 90% of these companies that ended up becoming billion-dollar companies were venture-backed. And, you know, something less than, you know, about 8% of them were bootstrapped, and like a little bit less than 1% were self-financed, which is the founder had the means to invest in the company and that for the first 4 years of the company. So again, this doesn't say anything good or bad about the bootstrap companies. You know, obviously there's a smaller number of companies that are bootstrap. And also it talks about, you know, the kind of goals, and, you know, VCs want to take risky bets. And I talk about the math behind venture capital funds and that how, you know, even for a small venture capital fund, even for a $300 million venture capital fund, they need a $2 billion exit for it to move needle and work for them. So it's partly rooted in the intentions. You know, it's amazing if you can create a $30 million a year business and you own it and you don't have venture capital backing, you take less risks and you own all that money. That's amazing. I think the people who should go through the venture capital route is the people who want to take these risks of either losing the company or becoming a 10 or 2 or $5 billion company. So it's a very different route, and it should be, you know, reserved for those type of risky bets.
And what I love about this statement that you make here is that it's not just an empty statement, because you already have the next data set available to sort of prove the point that you just made, that there's a place for venture capital, and it's the capital intensive business models. And you talk about this and collected some data on this, that most of these $1 billion startups, they are actually, I think it's 58% of them are in what you classify as very capital intensive business models. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think a lot of times we think that most businesses are like super capital light, but it turns out a lot of these companies require a lot of capital to get to the minimum scale that's needed for them to kind of work out and for the network effects to work out. And they require like a minimum of funding to get to that scale, that things work out, that the unit economics work out, that the venture scale works out. So a larger than expected, you know, percentage of these billion-dollar companies had business models that was not necessarily capital light. And also I talk about, you can be capital efficient even if your company, even if your business model is not capital light.
Now let's talk about the capital. An interesting finding you have is that the first funding rounds of the billion-dollar startup cohort compared to the random cohort is significantly larger. Maybe talk a little bit about the fundraising trajectory.
Yeah, so what I saw in the data, the companies that ended up becoming billion-dollar outcomes, on average, had raised much larger seed rounds and much larger A rounds and at a faster cadence compared to the random group. Which tells you something. It doesn't tell you if you raise more, you're more likely to succeed. It tells you that these founders, even from day one, maybe had the network, maybe had, you know, the previous track record, or like an interesting idea that they could capture the imagination of investors from day one. So a lot of these kind of companies, they weren't obvious deals from day one, but they were interesting deals, or they were strong deals, even from the Series C and Series A rounds. And also in another chart, I talk about, you know, even in the first and second round of them, 60% of these, you know, companies that ended up becoming unicorns raised their first round of funding from these brand name VCs. Again, it doesn't mean because a brand name VC invested in them, they became a billion-dollar company. It means they were a strong team and a strong company. And even from the first round, they were able to raise capital from, you know, great investors.
It's quite interesting to think about this signal investors in the first round. And you mentioned there that 60% of these billion-dollar companies raised from top-tier VC firms. And then maybe as a last point, let's talk about the years it takes to hatch for these companies to pop. There's this old saying again, it's an overnight success, 10 years in the making. There are a couple of companies that really pop after one or 2 years. And I think the cycles are getting shorter and shorter recently with this dynamic in the growth equity space. But maybe talk a little bit about the time it takes to hatch.
Right. So, you know, a lot of these kind of, yes, that's right. They're not overnight successes. But a lot of it goes back to, you know, what these founders had done before actually starting this company, before coming up with the idea, their previous, you know, startups or things that they had done. You're right that the cycle is getting, you know, faster and faster, and it might be signs of, you know, getting into a frothy market. But I think on average, you know, a good number of these companies became unicorns, some in 4 years, some in 6 years. You have companies that, you know, just became a unicorn like within 1 or 2 years. We have like Clubhouse now, that thing happened to it. But, you know, there's been companies that it took more than 12 years also to become a unicorn. So it's a very wide range from, you know, 1 years to 12 years or even more.
All right. So Ali, as we're running against the clock, I have one last question to ask you. What's the next step in your research journey? Are you going to turn this into a PhD, or what's the next plan?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know yet. It's a very valuable data set. So I'm trying to see, you know, what are the possibilities from it? How can it help me become a better investor, have less bias when I'm deciding on investments, and also use it as a framework for making better investment decisions and for sourcing companies better?
Absolutely love it. And so Ali, where can people find out more about you and what you're up to?
Yeah, so the book is now available on Amazon, Kindle, Audible, you know, and wherever they sell books. So you can go and order it there. And the website of the book is called superfoundersbook.com. And if you want, you can follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn, Ali Tomasev.
Thank you, Ali, for being with us here today.
Awesome. I was glad to be here.